kingdom on the Sabbath, and did all sorts of things on the Sabbath that the rule-keeping Pharisees said he shouldn't do. He was the perfect embodiment of being free, living free, and focusing on enjoying his rest. We try to follow suit and all too quickly realize this Jesus pace is harder than we think. We don't really know what to do with freedom. Can we trust ourselves? What if we fail? Like a toddler who has just learned to toddle, we think, the only way I'll know I'm out of bounds here is when somebody big yells no. This may be one of the reasons we are so averse to play and prefer the tedium of work, wrote Allender. Freedom scares us. We demand freedom, yet we fear the risk required to recreate in a manner that has such openness, vulnerability, and potential for failure. We want freedom, yes, but will we know what to do with it once it's ours? Thankfully, Jesus knows how to steward freedom well, and in typical fashion, he didn't hoard the information, keeping the secrets to life to himself. Instead, he put on flesh, came to planet Earth, and asked us to taste head-to-toe liberation for ourselves. Upon close examination, I find that all of Jesus' commands were actually invitations in disguise. Granted, they are framed in a commanding voice. Repent, follow me, let your light shine, honor God's law, keep your word, go the second mile, love your enemies, seek God's kingdom, do not judge, take my yoke, honor your parents, deny yourself, forgive offenders, be a servant, be born again, feed my sheep, make disciples. The list goes on, but based on John 14 verse 15, these commands are actually based in love. If you love me, the verse says, show it by doing what I've told you. We follow Jesus' injunctions because Jesus is the one we love. But like so many other plainly true things, we don't believe this truth is true. We get to the thing about coming to him when we are weary so that he can give us rest, Matthew 11, verse 28, and we think, command. I don't like commands. Quit telling me what to do. When in fact, we should be thinking, invitation. This is an invitation. More specifically, this is a God-given gift. Receiving rest as a gift from God. Whenever I catch a whiff of Sabbath-keeping legalism in someone I'm talking to, I encourage him or her with this very advice, to start treating rest not as a command, but as a gift. This ought to be task number one on your restfulness to-do list, I tell the person. I mean, if you're going to have a list, then this should be at the top. A gift is something everybody likes. Who can refuse a gift? When someone offers to buy me a nice meal, for instance, or I've been invited to use a friend's beach home, or I get an unexpected treat in the mail. These things don't exactly add stress to my life. They make me exhale, they make my shoulders fall, and they make me smile. The effect is the very opposite of stress, which is the point exactly. This is how it goes with a gift, and how it ought to go with rest. A recent Saturday, when Pam and our kids were in Louisiana visiting family, was this type of gift for me. I had helped lead a youth conference at our church all weekend that culminated with a wonderfully inspiring worship service Friday night. The experience was fantastic, but by Saturday morning, I was toast. I woke later than usual, 7:30 I think it was, and as my eyes blinked open and my mind came to, I thought, this day of rest, this is a gift. I thanked my father aloud. God, thank you for this gift. I missed my family, but I received the time as a gift. A gift is something to be opened and savored. A gift is something to enjoy. I drank coffee and read and prayed and read some more. I leaned in as God revealed some areas of my heart that needed work, and I thanked him for showing me two specific ways I could be a better dad to my two amazing kids. I took a hike, literally, and continued to talk with God. Then, after showering and dressing, I drove down to Whole Foods to shop for something to eat. The guy manning the seafood counter said they just that afternoon received some shrimp, fresh from the Gulf. It's pretty rare we get these, he said. Done. Dinner was decided there on the spot. The cooking process was slow but effective, and a few hours later, I set before myself a plate of home-cooked Cajun shrimp, at which point I thanked God profusely for edible ocean life. It had actually been my intention to go slow, to clean and devein and sauté and prepare. I'd wanted this to be an event, not a task. And it was. And my heart was full because of it. 14 solid hours of wake time, and not a single minute was rushed. What's more, nothing of measurable value was accomplished. No task list was completed. No ambition was promoted. No production whatsoever to report. It was sweet time with God. No agenda, no real outcome. Nothing except fellowship with Him. Progress, to be sure. The following day was intense due to the departure of a beloved member of our staff team who took a role in another church, and then I had scheduled a rigorous day of writing that Monday. I remember driving home Monday evening thinking, even after the last 2 days, I still have something left in the tank. I had filled up so much on Saturday, emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and physically, that I was sort of skipping through my week. Well, not skipping. I wouldn't picture a field of daisies exactly, but I certainly felt less burdened. I wasn't weighed down as I sometimes am. Rest had yielded good returns. For so long I refused to buy into that idea, but it was proving to be the truth. Receiving rest as a gift is not unlike conducting a spiritual Where's Waldo search. You know those red and white stripes are somewhere, you just have to seek them out. I was getting ready for bed last night, and heard the soft whap, whap, whap of rain falling on the roof. I'm a sucker for a good rainstorm, and so I beelined it for the back deck, settled into a comfortable chair there under the eaves, and watched the drama unfold. Vibrant lightning, a cool wind, thunder rumbling off in the distance. I grinned as I imagined God with a conductor's wand in hand, orchestrating the entire show. The performance was gone as quickly as it had started, but I was there to see it. What's more, I saw it not merely as condensation falling to earth, but I saw it as a gift. I feel the same way each spring when I catch sight of the season's first robin redbreast, or when I detect those tiny buds finally bursting through the beds of mulch. Gift. Each one a bona fide gift. When I was with Eugene and Jan Peterson at their Montana home, Eugene took me on a walk along the perimeter of his property. A mutual friend once told me that Eugene could name and give the origin of every single plant on his grounds, and what I was seeing were a lot of plants. Who is that tuned in to his surroundings? Of course, it is someone who lives life at rest. And so I pay attention as I rest. Or I try to pay attention anyway. I try to slow down, to look around, to take in with grateful eyes the immediate world in which I live. On this topic of paying attention, of silencing all distractions in favor of tuning into God and His handiwork, author Rachel Held Evans once wrote, "My inner voice can be a royal pain in the rear. An obstreperous child, impatient with questions and eager for attention, my inner voice likes to focus on the future, not the present." And already she had some rather strong opinions about lunch. Quiet, 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 I kept telling myself. Embrace the silence. Focus on God. But nothing seemed to work. My mind kept drifting from one thing to another, and before I knew it, I was outlining an article in my head. Finally, I remembered something my agent told me before I left for this retreat. When you're on the spiritual retreat, she said, don't try too hard to make something mystical happen. Just go and be. If you enter with too many expectations, you'll be disappointed. Reflecting on that time away, she later said, "So what did God say to me in the silence that morning?" I'm not sure, but I think it was something like, "Don't try so hard, little child," and, "Hey, check out this cool turtle I made." You receive the gift when you listen to yourself breathe. It happens when you put down the phone, or close the laptop, or cease tweeting for even 10 seconds and open your ears to a neighbor needing to talk. It can happen when you watch your teenage son shuffle toward the refrigerator, grab the OJ from the shelf, take a swig right from the carton, and then sheepishly smile as he turns and sees that he's been caught. You half-heartedly shake your head in response and grin, thinking not thoughts of indictment, of frustration, but of grateful disbelief that he's gotten so big. It happens when you take time to appreciate a splendid and too short rainstorm. It happens when you hold your spouse close and whisper, "I love you," into a ready ear. It happens when you live out a passage of scripture you've read with mild indifference a dozen times. And yes, it happens when you notice the turtle paddling along there in the gurgling creek. When you're looking, you will find them, these outstanding gifts from God. And when you open up a hand to receive them, that's when you get rest right. Thanking God for the gift of rest. After a wildfire in our neighboring community of Black Forest, more than 500 homes were deemed total losses, 25 of them owned by families who are part of our church. One couple in their 60s lost everything except the clothes on their backs. They were relieved to have escaped alive, but as you'd expect, they felt naked without any of their things. No toothbrushes, no underwear, no spare pairs of shoes, none of their computers, none of their photo albums, none of their socks or towels or books. Sure, these things could all be replaced, but for the three-week period following their evacuation, life for them felt empty and barren and sad. All their systems had been disrupted. Everything familiar to them was now gone. The couple fled to the home of good friends, close friends, friends who take you in when everything has been lost, who lived several miles south of the burn area. This is what the church does during crisis. We rally to meet the needs we find. So this pair appeared on the doorstep, separately, because the wife had been at the gym working out, and the husband had been at work before making a mad dash to their home, grabbing their cat and two dogs, and then racing back up his street. And they said, "We have no way of knowing if our house will make it, but we've been evacuated for the foreseeable future until fire safety personnel can get in there, do an assessment, and let us know what's next." Before they could make their actual request, "Can we stay in your guest room for a while?" their friends hugged them and ushered them inside and said, "What's ours is yours. Stay as long as you like." They then pointed the jittery couple toward the spare bedroom, invited them to use the fresh towels in the bathroom cabinet if they wanted to clean up, and said that dinner was already underway and that there was plenty to go around. As I mentioned, it was a full 3 weeks before the couple was able to find a house to rent, somewhere to call home, because theirs had, in fact, burned to the ground. And during that 21-day period, sorrow would wash over them like the never-ending waves of the sea. One moment they'd be mourning the decades-old family portraits they'd never be able to replace, and the next, they'd find themselves laughing over the general amusements of daily life. They'd feel buoyed by the momentary uplift, the smiles, only to be knocked down by the next wave of grief. It was exhausting, the wife later admitted, but still they found a way to cope. Each evening after dinner, but before everyone was weary and ready for bed, the four adults would gather on the back deck, and there beside the flickering flame of a candle, they'd recount God's faithfulness from the day. At first it was slim pickings. "Well, we had to go meet with our insurance agent," the husband might say. "And while there is a ton of red tape involved in a situation like this," our agent said, probably in passing, "I'm sorry for your loss." It was a trivial thing, I guess, but today it felt like a gift from God. They'd go on this way for 15 or 20 minutes, no more than that most nights, speaking aloud the gifts they believed were from the hand of God: a good night's sleep the previous night, an extension on a work deadline, news that another neighbor was safe and sound, the generosity of loving friends. And then they would blow out the candle and get ready for bed, and gear up to tackle the trying tasks the next day surely would bring. It takes a special sort of strength to thank God for the gift of rest, especially when rest doesn't feel like a gift. For this couple, life had tossed a set of circumstances their way they absolutely did not want, and yet even there, in the ambiguity and frustration and pain, they viewed the 3 week period of rest as a gift, and they thanked God for that gift. Thankfulness works magic on a harried heart. When we insist on being grateful, on seeking out places to point our praise, our rhythms can't help but write themselves. Our heart rates can't help but come down. I got my professional start in journalism and remain an admirer of stars in the field, one of the brightest of whom is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Catherine Ellison. According to her official bio, in addition to authoring 4 books and serving both as a foreign correspondent and later as a writing consultant, Ellison has traveled underground with Eritrean guerrillas fighting the Ethiopian government, reported from the front lines of U.S.-backed wars in Central America, hunted for Nazis in Paraguay and Argentina, and spent a week traveling with a band of Huichol Indians during their annual ceremonial peyote hunt in central Mexico. She has been taken hostage by Mexican peasants, arrested by Cuban police, tear-gassed in Panama, chased by killer bees, and required to watch more World Cup events than she cares to remember. The woman has been busy. And yet you get the feeling from reading one of her latest books, Buzz, A Year of Paying Attention, that more chaotic than all these episodes put together has been the chaos of raising a clinically distracted son. Ellison's son, whom she and her husband nicknamed Buzz for his always frenetic energy, was diagnosed with ADHD as a child, plunging the couple into a difficult and demoralizing world. Across his adolescent years, Buzz was often angry, sometimes violent, and always misunderstood. He chased off all his childhood friends and most of his younger brother's friends, finally reaching a breaking point. Ellison considered boarding school or some other sort of long-term option that would get Buzz out of the house. She even revealed the plan to her son on the heels of one especially frustrating afternoon, explaining with tight lips in a serious tone, "You will not destroy this family." What Ellison didn't realize early on was that her own clinical distraction, she too had been diagnosed with an attention deficit disorder along the way, was feeding the beast of her son's disobedience. She wrote, "An innately challenging child can easily wear down the average parent, and in particular the scatterbrained parent. The child's extraordinary resistance leads that parent either to back off or resort to harsh punishment, making the child even more angry and aggressive, and so on, until everything falls apart." Armed with this new insight, and still desperate for relational relief, the Ellison seized every opportunity for healing they could find, including everything from medication to meditation, cognitive therapy to powdered soy shakes, neurofeedback, hair analysis, genetic testing, special diets, and summer camps dedicated to organizational skills. They also tried custom exercise routines, tinted contact lenses, horseback therapy, and swimming with dolphins. She jokes that with a little more time and an ounce more exasperation, exorcism would have been next on their list. Still, at the end of it all, Buzz was still Buzz, complete with his anger, his cynicism, and his grief. And the fractured family was still writhing in pain. Clearly, something drastic needed to be done. The question, she and her husband feared, wasn't if something tragic would become of the Ellisons as a result of Buzz's issues, but when. It's widely known in ADHD circles that kids who suffer from the disorder face some pretty sobering statistics. They have, for example, 4 times as many car accidents as those who aren't affected. They have 5 times the rate of suicide attempts and 10 times as many teen pregnancies. They're also more than twice as likely to be arrested and up to 3 times as likely to abuse alcohol and drugs. What's more, the disorder in children has been linked to significantly higher rates of divorce by their parents and to a greater chance that the children will be physically abused. It may be invisible from the outside, but the suffering it causes is all too obvious. Ellison had a solution in mind. Rather than pay for additional medical and psychiatric interventions, she would simply pay attention to her son. She would apply her investigative journalist's eye to the struggling young man living under her own roof and see what she could learn. She would slow down, step back, let go of her expectations, and take in life through a totally different lens. She did this not for a day or a week, but for a full year, her observations forming the spine of her book. Once she had hindsight on her side, she would say, "If I've learned anything by now, it's that kids like Buzz do best with parents who aren't having tantrums right back at them, or even frantically checking email every 5 minutes. Parents able to listen closely and explain things patiently and repeatedly. Yet this sort of self-control so easily eludes me when I'm in my default mode of scrambling around in frustration over projects left up in the air. And so she would practice listening closely and explaining things patiently and generally avoiding the chain reaction that tumbles forth when a parent responds angrily, judgmentally to a child. "I've come to believe that the only way to break this chain," she said, "is to keep in mind William James' idea that what you pay attention to becomes your reality, and, when possible, to keep my focus fixed on the best parts of people's natures." Ellison's newfound focus paid off. Things didn't go perfectly, but while the relationship is still admittedly a work in progress, she describes it as restored. She explains, "I know I've already seen glimpses of the gifts Buzz may one day unwrap. Somewhere inside my son, I am learning to trust there's a good man just trying to get out." And she chooses to pay attention to that goodness, to the host of things she is learning that she might not have learned had she parented an easier kid. As strange as this may sound, I bring this up not as a parenting example, but as a paying attention example for both you and me. The truth is, I read Ellison's story and found myself relating a little too well. I may never have been diagnosed with clinical distraction, but I've been plagued with distraction of the spiritual sort for years, and I believe it is no less severe. Sure, maybe I can mask my dysfunction better, presenting a more socially acceptable front, but still it lurks under the surface, causing me to embrace chaos as readily as Buzz. I look back on old patterns with disgust, the overworking that almost cost me my marriage, the blatant disregard for the feelings of close friends, the mental hopscotch that has sabotaged so many times of study and prayer, and I consider how weary I became in doing good. The Bible says not to do that, and now, all these years later, I think I know why. Margin author Richard Swenson says that whenever he confronts Christians about their out-of-control pace of life, he braces for the response he most often gets, which is some iteration of Philippians 4, verse 13, "But I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Richard wants to ask, "Can you? Can you fly? Can you go 6 months without eating?" Neither can you live a healthy life chronically overloaded. I'm not sure I ever really gave Christ such credit for my pressure cooker pace, but I certainly subscribe to the "I can do all things" way of life. And did I ever learn the hard way that nobody can do everything, at least not without paying a steep price? At last I recognize my bedhead days for what they are, no less than salvation through and through. Pulling away to enter the rest of God isn't a fun little hobby I can afford to do without. As Ellison discovered, paying attention, keen, heartfelt attention, is the key to living sanely in an insane world. It's the only way the chaos gets calmed. The formula junkies who prod me for day of rest do's and don'ts miss the point entirely. It's not the rules, but the relationship. If you're genuinely, lovingly paying attention to God in your rest, the rest of what you do or don't do doesn't matter at all. Breaking busy. Challenge number one, thank God. You've had several opportunities to practice healthy, rhythmic living to this point, both for an entire day and also throughout the course of your typical daily life. Hopefully you've seized those opportunities and benefited from them. The challenge this time around is for you to acknowledge the one who provides real rest in the first place, your Heavenly Father. As you experience moments of Shabbat Shalom this week, quiet moments when you can actually breathe, when the frenetic pace of life is divinely kept at bay, thank God for the gift of rest. You might whisper a prayer, jot down a journal entry, or simply look skyward and say thanks. Let Him know you are aware of the gift He's providing and that you're actually receiving it in the spirit with which it came. Challenge number two, find your buzz. Just as Catherine Ellison saw great gains in her relationship with her son when she ceased trying to fix him and instead simply paid attention to the goodness embedded in him, his realities and his needs, You too can realize significant benefits by training your eye, your energy, and your attention on the positive aspects of a part of your life that feels broken or wounded or raw. For this challenge, choose the object of your dissatisfaction, a key relationship, a seemingly immovable obstacle at work, your weight, your bank account, whatever, and note what you observe. What causes you pain there? Why is the situation so tough? Now, write down something positive about the circumstance or relationship, some aspect of goodness that still remains. What steps can you take this week and this month to build on that goodness you've declared? Consider asking a friend to hold you accountable to taking those steps sooner rather than later. Chapter 9. Three Things I Wish I'd Known. Sometimes I lie awake at night and ask, "Where have I gone wrong?" Then a voice says to me, "This is going to take more than one night." Charles M. Schulz. Avoiding Pitfalls Along the Road to Rest. I've been a pastor for nearly 2 decades now, and throughout this time I've been the product of on-the-job training. Maybe every job is this way. Do you know any good doctors or lawyers or teachers or artists who quit learning years ago? I don't either. Nor do I know any good pastors who aren't continually refining their craft. So while I'm not opposed to having to learn as I go, having to fight to stay a half step ahead of the congregation I've been tasked with leading, having to study and read and restudy and reread so that I can provide something worthwhile come Sunday morning, there are a handful of things I wish somebody had told me before I got started. Things I didn't have to learn the hard way. Things like this. No matter how hard I try, I'll always be tempted to measure my success by my church's attendance numbers. Or, the best thing I can do for my congregation is to quit comparing myself to other pastors and simply strive to be genuinely me. Or, because it takes a long time to become old friends, I ought to nurture and cherish the old friendships I have. Or, I will only be given as much spiritual authority as the amount of spiritual authority I'm willing to submit to. Or, my brain will always, always feel like scrambled eggs on Sunday afternoon and again all day Monday. I will do well to hold all decisions until Tuesday. Or, I will never regret spending time with my family. Or, while it's true that sheep bites can't kill me, the general congregational gnawing every pastor is made to withstand will make life absolutely miserable a few very long days each year. Granted, when you learn the hard way, the lessons get ingrained in you like the brand on cattle's behinds. But I doubt any cow would describe that process as fun. No, personally, I'd recommend the easy way out. I'm more stubborn than the average guy, so in reality, people probably did tell me the things I needed to know all those years ago. Most likely, I just didn't have ears to hear. My spirit probably revolted, thinking, "I'll figure it out on my own, thank you very much." Only, I doubt I actually said thanks. Perhaps you're the same way. If you have a bit of driver in your personality, a smidge of type A behavior in how you roll, then you too will insist on learning the hard way. You will be one of the growing group of people who have learned the hard way horror stories to tell about odorless gas leaks, about Rottweilers and children, about weekend warriors and ACL surgery, and about nearly killing yourself before you learned to appreciate rest. If, however, you are a less stubborn person, or even a stubborn one who happens to be in a teachable mood, then this chapter is for you. The three things I wish I'd known long ago, but didn't, might help you avoid a pitfall or two along the path to living a rhythmic life. Number 1. Rest is opposed. The first rhythmic life lesson I learned the hard way is this. Our rest is opposed. During the early days of my marriage, when I was running too fast and pushing too hard, I found it incredibly difficult to come down. I feared rest. I feared the loneliness and boredom I knew rest would usher in, and so I kept the pedal to the metal, upping my RPMs higher and higher, while praying each and every moment that I'd somehow avoid a crash. But the reality is that we always have to come down. We can't stay up forever. And because I refused to learn how to slow myself in a healthy manner, I was forced to walk an unhealthy path, a path paved with internet porn. From a place of deep humility, I have shared with my congregation how challenging it was to untangle myself from the grip of pornography across the span of several years in my 20s. But by God's grace, I did get free. For quite a while, I looked back on that stretch of sinfulness with disbelief. How could I stoop to that level? I was in ministry. I was supposedly living for God. I adored and admired my wife. And yet still, I'd find myself sitting in front of a computer screen long after Pam had gone to bed, staring at stuff I had no business staring at, regretting the minutes, even as they tick by. Things make more sense to me now. When you and I don't say yes to God's form of rest, we will say yes to a fraudulent form of rest, cooked up by the enemy of our souls. We will say yes to porn or to booze or to drugs or to gambling or to idle chatter or to extravagant spending, all in the name of unwinding. This is what we'll declare, anyway, when pressed to justify our sinful ways. It's all proof that real rest is opposed, that rest without God is not rest at all. My friend John Eldridge likes to say, caring for your heart is the first blow against the enemy's schemes. And he's absolutely right. Satan hates it when we truly come down in a good and godly way, because that's when spiritual transformation happens. That's when soulish growth takes place. That's when we become like God. I've long been fascinated with the American Civil War and recently caught a PBS documentary on the Battle of Gettysburg, aired in conjunction with the 150th anniversary of the campaign. Gettysburg happened almost exactly at the halfway point of the four-year war and is considered by many historians to be the turning point for Union forces, who would defeat the Confederacy in the end. As I watched the reenactment of the specific scenes that made up this battle, Robert E. Lee's high-flying spirits as he marched his troops into Pennsylvania, both sides' strategic use of ridges, town streets, and hills to sneak up on and take down opposition soldiers, the Union's ability to hold their lines despite suffering a ridiculous number of casualties, Meade's defeat of Southern attacks, which would end Lee's invasion of the North, I was intrigued not only by the sweeping maneuvering, but also by the utter minutiae involved. So many microscopic actions, reactions, decisions, determinations, and declarations. So many tiny things that added up to something huge in the end, something that looked a lot like victory. The Confederates had every opportunity to win the war there at Gettysburg, but they did not. For the Union Army, tending to the minor details meant a major win in the grand scheme of things, which leads me to my point. When we recognize that real rest is opposed, that the enemy absolutely hates it when we unwind in a godly way, we realize that we too are at war. It's a war, and the spoils are our souls, and yet tiny disciplines can yield the biggest of wins. I'm reminded I'm at war when my family finally sits down for dinner, to pray, to eat, to relax, and someone's phone rings. Or when I get all settled on the back deck for half an hour of solitude with God, and my kids choose then to be chatty. Or when I set aside a day for hiking and communing with God, and a freak snowstorm blows into town. Or when I block off a weekend on the calendar to stay home without any to-dos, and unwind from a harried pace, and out-of-state friends decide to come to Colorado for a visit. Or when I actually plan a whole week of vacation and I catch a vicious flu bug the morning of day one. All these things have happened to me, and they'll happen again and again. Why? Because we're at war, and the enemy hates to lose. I begin to win the war, battle by battle, incident by incident, one seemingly innocuous campaign after another, when I silence the phone and keep my family's dinnertime conversation afloat, when I embrace my kids there on the back deck, tend to their immediate needs, and then tell them I'll be with them in 20 minutes or so. When instead of cursing that freak snowstorm, I watch with awe as it blows through. When I carve out an hour on day two of my house guest's visit to pull away, to retreat alone with God. And when I laugh in the face of vacation time illness, instead of allowing it to derail my entire week. Remember the scene we looked at in an earlier chapter when Jesus told the wind and the waves to be still? This was actually the second time Jesus had withdrawn for a little solitude, but was quickly summoned back to his disciples to save the day. Both times, natural storms interrupted his rest. This is the way it always goes, even for Jesus Christ. Something always interrupts our rest, because real rest is always opposed. The old Scotsman, Sir James Matthew Barrie, the one who created Peter Pan, once quipped in his charming Anglo-Saxon style, "Has it ever struck you that the trouts bite best on the Sabbath? God's critters tempting decent men." I'm willing to concede the point that Satan isn't behind every sidetracking scheme. Sometimes maybe it really is just a mischievous fish. Either way, I've learned that unless I commit myself to minding my mind, I defer to the distraction every time. A few years ago, I experienced a dramatic case of letting distraction rule my days. I was going through a rough patch relationally with another pastor, and over the course of several months, I noticed that whatever free time I had in the early morning, between meetings, during my drive home, I'd use up by imagining conversations with this person. I'd replay in my mind the last exchange we'd had, and then I'd play out what I wanted to say next, as well as how I thought he'd respond. In his book Social Intelligence, author Daniel Goleman, who also wrote the bestseller Emotional Intelligence, said that rehashing our social lives may rate as the brain's favorite downtime activity, which tells me I'm far from alone in this regard. We fondle our social relationships, turning them over again and again in our minds. We revisit memories. We plot future exchanges. We wish for do-overs where we come across as witty and wise. And while there is nothing inherently wrong with this practice, it sure does siphon unassigned time. During the specific occurrence I mentioned, my motivations were actually pretty pure. I wasn't intending to waste time. I was hoping to redeem a relationship. But the fact of the matter was that I was using all my energy having imaginary conversations with a man rather than investing it more prudently by having actual conversations with God. One morning in my office, when I had headed over to my credenza for a fresh cup of coffee, I sensed God saying, "You know, you're giving a lot of mental space to this, even though the conversations you're envisioning are never going to transpire." In response, I said, "You're right." Admittedly, it was a brief exchange. God was right, and I knew it. I needed to start minding my mind. Later, I talked to the entire staff about what had happened, explaining that spinning our wheels over virtual conversations only serves to stir us up, while bringing our challenges to God calms us down and puts our anxious thoughts to rest. I didn't mandate anything to our staff that day, and I didn't have to. Lectures, diatribes, and strict enforcement of rules pale in comparison to the power of sheer truth. To the issue of minding our minds, I once heard a story of a monk who, in the course of everyday life, periodically rang what's called a mindfulness bell. People nearby who heard the bell would stop what they were doing and take 3 silent, mindful breaths. Then they would continue their work, awakened ever so slightly by the simple act of pausing, of breathing, of practicing mindfulness. I love this idea, and it's more practical than we may first think. I vote for ringing a mindfulness bell throughout our days, whether we have an actual bell or not. Maybe the bell is the instant your feet hit the floor in the morning. Or maybe it's each time you slip behind the wheel of your car. Maybe you set a bell chime as your ringtone, and thus it sounds each time you receive a call. The bell could be sitting down to a meal or kissing your spouse at the end of the day and every time you stop to pray. With a little creative thought, you and I can come up with some reminder to focus our thoughts, to mind our minds, to choose to rest in God. The great Vince Lombardi once said, Winning is a habit, an idea that transcends the world of sports. We practice taking every thought captive because minor habits really do wind up equaling major wins in the end. Number 2. Ruthlessness is required. A second lesson I wish I hadn't had to learn the hard way is that when it comes to rest, ruthlessness is required. Living rhythmically may sound like a breezy proposition, but to execute it well, we have to stand our ground. About 18 months ago, I called together the most senior leaders of New Life Church. These are the men and women who report directly to me, the ones who oversee every ministry within our church. It's a great group of people, visionary minds, expansive hearts, and hands ever ready to serve. But due to a string of crises and personnel changes, not to mention the nation's economic downturn that affected every church across this land, our shared working relationship had fallen off track. As a leader, I'm a big fan of delegation, of trusting the team, of giving away all the control I don't actually need, all things my senior staff is well aware of. But situations beyond our control had forced us to up the ante on our communications for more than 3 years. I asked to be part of decisions I normally wouldn't need to weigh in on because our circumstances demanded that I did. A founding pastor scandal, a fatal shooting on your campus, and a fast and furious financial downturn can do that to a group. But then that 3-year period came to a close, and the stress level let up a bit. This would have been terrific news, except that I completely missed the cue that we had clawed our way out of the woods, and so my senior staff kept bringing me what I now instinctively believed were junior-level questions, and my frustration level only went up. Unwittingly, I'd neglected to inform them that we had shifted from crisis mode to normal everyday mode, and all of us were suffering mightily as a result. They were trying to include me in their minutiae, and I was expending precious energy fending off their incessant requests. You'll recall that at various points throughout my life, I had a huge need to be needed, which was fed by work associates' never-ending string of demands. If someone was needed to teach a class, my hand shot up in the air. If someone was needed to drive the bus, I was ready to roll. If someone was needed to launch the ministry, I was the guy to tap. If someone was needed to lead the charge, I was there, fist raised in the air. So it was more than a little gratifying to realize I'd matured enough in my desire for rest that I would turn down all these flattering requests for my input, for my wisdom, for my direction and counsel and advice. Brady, what should we do about filling this position? Brady, how would you handle this conflict? Brady, what are your thoughts on approving this vacation? Brady, how should we proceed? They were the woodpeckers, and I was the tree. A guy could die from being needed this much. I called the meeting for the purpose of informing them that if they preferred a pastor who was alive, then they would resume handling their own affairs. To which they said, all due respect, Pastor Brady, but you created this madness you now despise. They were right, and all of us knew it. We had the discussion about how we'd come through the various crises and now could resume normal operations, but not before applauding Pastor Brady for not needing to be needed anymore. Not every day, anyway. There are 3 things a pastor has to do well: lead, shepherd, and communicate. And I know pastors who love to do all 3 in equal measure. They can oversee meetings, prep for sermons, and speak until they're blue in the face, and they are delighted the entire time. I am not one of those pastors. I don't love these things. I like these things, and I am somewhat good at these things, but love them? Not so much. At least not in an infinite way. Eventually, I become bored with meetings, weary with studying, and annoyed with hearing my own voice. As a result, I employ all sorts of systemic gymnastics in order to thrive week after week. I delegate meeting authority. I meet with a diverse team for sermon prep. Regarding all manner of goings-on around New Life, I opt out as often as I opt in. I do these things to stay sane. I do these things so that sheer chaos doesn't have its evil way in my life. This is a godly way to lead, by the way. You can see for yourself by reading Exodus chapter 18. Briefly, Moses had led the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, a process that involved escaping Pharaoh's clutches, miraculously crossing the Red Sea, worrying over food and water, encountering and defeating the Amalekite army, and frequently wrestling with whether they would choose to trust God. With the drama and near-death experiences behind them, they were able to set up shop near the mountain of God and establish some semblance of normal life. Moses' father-in-law, a man named Jethro, got wind of this wild turn of events and decided to pay Moses a visit to see how things were going. Upon Jethro's arrival, he and Moses exchanged hugs and kisses, and then swapped stories of God's faithfulness over a meal. The next day it was business as usual, as Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people. Verse 13. Jethro stood back and watched as his son-in-law stayed in that chair from morning until night, deliberating disputes among the people he led. And then he had to speak up. "What are you doing?" he asked Moses. And Moses responded, "This is my job. I am their judge." And he was telling the truth. The Israelites would bring every quarrel among them to Moses for resolution, because Moses was the guy in charge. He was the only one who knew the decrees and instructions God wanted enforced. And so they would have an argument. And then they'd come to Moses to explain their argument, and then Moses would tell them, biblically, what to do. It would have been a fine plan, except that Moses was a man, a mortal man, a man who wasn't Superman. He needed rest and relief as much as the next guy, and this pace eventually wore him out. "The work is too heavy for you," Jethro told him. "You cannot handle it alone." Verse 18. This gets back to the can versus should argument, doesn't it? Perhaps Moses could have done the work, but should he have? Of course, the answer is no. And so Jethro devised a plan. Teach them, the people, his decrees and instructions, and show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave, Jethro said. Select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. That will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied. Verses 20 through 23. In other words, delegate, delegate, delegate. And this is exactly what Moses chose to do. In a momentary flash of brilliance, he chose to be ruthless about getting some rest. In hindsight, I recognize that living by healthy rhythms requires a ruthlessness many people aren't willing to let play out. We're worried about what others will think. We're afraid we'll come across as unfeeling and cold. We're concerned that if we no longer need to be needed, someday we really won't be needed at all. But really, these fears don't prove warranted in the end. In reality, when we are ruthless about protecting our rest, we free up ourselves to be healthy and free up those around us to live rhythmically too. You probably remember this country's blue laws, which were most strictly enforced up until the mid-1980s. When I was a kid, on any given Sunday, it was illegal in most states in the Union to engage in commerce of any kind. You couldn't buy a pair of shoes to walk to the store. You couldn't buy a package of bacon once you got there, and you couldn't buy a pan to fry it in. Everything was closed. In many states still today, if it's Sunday, you'll be hard-pressed to buy a car from a car dealership because blue laws in that industry are still in effect. In our city of Colorado Springs, one car dealership in particular imposes a blue law of its own. It's open during the week only from 9 in the morning until 6 at night, despite most of its target market being unavailable to shop for new cars during those particular hours. One of its managers is a New Lifer, and he explained to me that the owner of the dealership said, "It's more important to me that our staff is home with their families each evening than if we sell an extra car or two." Workaholics will shake their heads at this logic, but I wonder if God smiles. Fail to plan and plan to fail and all that. He prefers our plans to center on Him. There is also a local home builder that, like national chains Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby, chooses to remain closed on Sundays. they run radio ads throughout southern Colorado explaining that the reason they choose not to be open on arguably the most popular home purchasing day of the week is that they view it as a non-negotiable top priority to let their staff worship with their families and rest. Society tends to mock these people, but in fact they're living by the rhythmic code. As the old cliche goes, burning the candle at both ends proves only that you're not very bright. As we discussed in the last chapter, the last thing I want to suggest is that legalism will do us any favors. It won't. But what these companies have learned is what I myself am learning. Ruthlessness paves the road to reliable rest. Number 3. The reward is the presence of God. There's a third lesson I've learned along the way, which is that the reward I'm constantly seeking is the persistent presence of God. We looked at an extended passage from Matthew 6 a couple of chapters ago that is worth revisiting now. There, Jesus tells his disciples that when they give to the poor, or when they pray, or when they fast, they should do these things not to be seen by other people, but only to be seen by God. He says that if those who love God announce their giving with trumpets, or shout their prayers from the street corners, or look somber while fasting, then they have received their reward in full. Verses 2, 5, and 16. Their reward, in other words, is the fleeting praise of other people. What he suggests is doing all these things in secret, thereby trusting God to dole out the rewards. See Matthew 6, verses 4, 6, and 18. But what does all this have to do with rest? I think of the words of Matthew 5, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God," verse 8. And I wonder if Jesus' exhortations in Matthew 6 were intended to form an exhaustive list, or whether, I happen to think this is the case, they were simply examples of righteous acts. I wonder if what Jesus was really saying was, "Whenever you practice any discipline of obscurity, let my Father's praise be enough." I think I expected a marching band to materialize after I started taking rest seriously. "Look at me, everyone. Look how seriously I'm taking God's injunction to rest. I'm a Sabbath keeper, folks, plain and simple, holy and righteous and good." I never would have admitted it publicly, but privately I think I hoped for some shiny angel to appear to deliver the divine prize package